loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Robert Bowers walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue on Saturday in Pittsburgh and opened fire with an AR-15 assault rifle. He's now facing 29 felony counts, including 11 counts of murder, with a hate crime enhancement. And the U.S. attorney says that he will seek the federal death penalty. Bowers is virulently anti-Semitic, and his online posts presaged the attack. Next, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that the number of troops the U.S. is sending to the border in anticipation of a migrant caravan is up from the reported 800 last week to 5,000. They're joining 2,000 National Guardsmen already there. Meanwhile, Mexican officials say that the size of the caravan has dropped by half as some migrants are electing to remain in Mexico's southern Chiapas state. Then, German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced this morning that she would resign from the leadership of the Christian Democratic Party in December and would not seek re-election as chancellor in 2021. The announcement was unexpected, but comes in light of a resounding defeat for Merkel's coalition in recent regional elections in Bavaria. And then the fight for stronger rent control in California appears to be headed for defeat. Proposition 10 would repeal the state's Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which strictly limits rent control in cities across California. It's blamed for the state having some of the highest rents in the country, but the latest polls show that Prop 10 will likely be defeated 60-40. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Pittsburgh. Robert Bowers walked into the Tree of Life Synagogue on Saturday in Pittsburgh and opened fire with an AR-15 assault rifle. He's now facing 29 felony counts, including 11 counts of murder with a hate crime enhancement, and the assistant U.S. attorney says that he will seek the federal death penalty. Robert Bowers' virulently anti-Semitic online posts presaged this attack. We'll talk about that and more. We're joined from Philadelphia by Mindy Iser, a labor organizer and a member of Philadelphia's Jewish community. Mindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mindy, your own assessment about what motivated this killer, Robert Bowers. Obviously, he's open about it, so we know he has a fascist, anti-Semitic, political, personal orientation. Maybe he's mentally ill. People say, oh, he's a loner. He's a mentally ill guy. But these things don't happen in a decontextualized sense. They happen within society at a given moment. What's your own take?
Yeah, I mean, people hate Jews. And the same people who hate Jews also hate Black people. They hate Muslims. They hate anyone who is not white and male. And I think something about anti-Semitism that functions in some ways differently than other oppressions is that it sort of diverts blame from the ruling class onto Jews, especially individual Jews. And so maybe this guy has had a hard life and is economically oppressed. And, you know, who, I don't know anything about him, who knows? But if anything has gone wrong in his personal life, instead of looking at, you know, the system that we all live in that's oppressive and exploitative, he's taught to look at Jews as the root of his problem. And that's like how anti-Semitism functions. And so it makes sense that people are feeling emboldened power to attack Jews these days.
Yeah. Mindy Iser, our guest, as a labor organizer in the Philadelphia area. Mindy, I know you as a labor organizer are aware of the slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all. That's a key to the concept of labor organizing, that workers, working people may be Black, they may be white, they may be Christian, they may be Muslim, they may be Jewish, they may be some other religion or people of no faith whatsoever. They may be American-born, they may be foreign-born, but they have things in common. And the things in common are they're oppressed or they're exploited or they have a common foe. They need to fight together in order to achieve any palpable improvement in their own life. as a labor organizer in the Philadelphia area, give us your own assessment nationwide, not just in Pennsylvania where you are, but nationwide in terms of the political rhetoric in society that goes in the opposite direction, the direction of extreme division, fear, paranoia, hatred. Talk about that in the political context. And do you see it on the rise? And what is the labor movement, or what can the labor movement, what can we do about it?
So I've been a union organizer for half a decade now, and I've worked on different campaigns with different kinds of workers and different industries. And one thing I found that's a constant and really interesting is many different, you know, members of our class talk about the Rothschilds and talk about the Illuminati and all of these conspiracies that kind of put Jewish people at the forefront as like the cause of why they're poor and why they're oppressed, and sort of blames like this mysterious like Jewish group for all of their problems. And I think it's really difficult to have those conversations with people because on one hand, like, yes, it's true, there is a group that is the cause of all of our problems. So that part is true, but it's not the Jews, it's the capitalists. And trying to have that conversation can be really painful and really difficult as a Jewish person. But I think more and more now, obviously anti-Semitism has been around forever, but you know, with Trump in the White House and white nationalists running for office unapologetically, it's easy for people to be open about hating Jews and blaming Jews for their problems. I mean, today I'm sending some texts for a universal home care ballot initiative in Maine, and someone responded like, "Stop sending me this George Soros socialism stuff. I don't want to hear it. Long live President Trump." So I think, you know, that's just the reality of the world we're living in.
The president of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith made a statement today. And in this statement, he said he lamented the fact that anti-Semitism has moved into the mainstream for the first time since the pre-World War II era, that it's actually mainstream to be anti-Semitic and to voice your anti-Semitism and your hate speech. Would you agree with that, Mindy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have a hard time. I don't want to align myself with the ADL in any way because although I think that they've done important work for the Jewish people, it's kind of like what you said about an injury to one is an injury to all. Like they are very anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian, and I don't want to be aligned with them. But yeah, definitely, I think it is now more than ever, it's totally okay to be anti-Semitic, especially with like the George Soros stuff that's been happening. Absolutely.
Meaning, let's just make sure the audience understands you when you say the George Soros stuff. What specifically do you mean?
Yeah, just how the right is blaming like any kind of left or even liberal like protesting or demonstrating or organizing on George Soros as if he's just like this very rich, which he is, of course, Jewish man with magical powers and is paying all of us and controlling all of us and making all of us get out in the streets. Like as if we wouldn't be doing it without his existence.
I think that's important. It is.
I used to laugh when people would say stuff like that. You can't laugh anymore because people believe it.
And here's the thing is that George Soros, who's closely aligned with the Democratic Party establishment and was closely aligned with Hillary Clinton, is funding some of the nonprofit organizations that have been engaged in anti-Trump protests. And what gets me as somebody who organizes also on the street is that, and this gets picked up by the media, including pro-Trump media, 95% or more of the demonstrations in this country against Trump's policies or against against Trump, they're not George Soros. That's false.
It is.
That's actually fake news, which doesn't mean George Soros and his groups are not funding some of it, but there's this conflation. George Soros, Democratic Party elites, Jews, billionaires, and then you have this toxic mix of anti-Semitism. And unless we, the people, are very clear that George Soros, the billionaire, does not speak for we grassroots opposition, and certainly not as Mindy is representing the labor movement, because he's the opposite of representing the labor movement. Unless we become clear about that, right-wing fascist ideology and narratives gain the upper hand. Mindy, we have 1 minute left. You take us out, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I also just want to add that I feel like the right wing has been using calls of anti-Semitism really cynically for a long time around people like me who support the BDS movement. And now when there's actual anti-Semitism happening, they're really silent. And, you know, that's its own kind of anti-Semitism, this deep obsession with Jews returning to Israel because they're just like evangelicals who actually like hate us and want to see us destroyed. So I think that's important to raise up.
Mindy Iser, quick point here. Again, picking up on what you just said about BDS, Netanyahu and the Israeli state and its leaders conflate the state of Israel and its practices with Judaism and with the Jewish people. What you're telling us as a Jewish person, as a progressive, is that you reject that kind of symmetry, that kind of sort of conflation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I don't believe in ethno-states. No one asked me if I wanted my own state. I don't believe in oppressing people on the basis of their religion or ethnicity. And I think the state of Israel is like goes against everything I was taught to think about Judaism and know about Judaism.
We'll leave it there. We were joined from Philadelphia by Mindy Iser, a labor organizer and a member of Philadelphia's Jewish community. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that the number of troops the U.S. is sending to the border in anticipation of a migrant caravan is up from the reported 800 last week to 5,000. These are active duty troops. They're joining 2,000 National Guardsmen already there. Meanwhile, Mexican officials say that the size of the caravan has dropped by half, as some migrants are electing to remain in Mexico's southern Chiapas state. We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barón, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Welcome back, Jorge.
Thank you for having me on, John and Brian. Thank you.
Jorge, tell me that these troop announcements are just political, because they don't make any real strategic or operational sense to me. If you're going to send troops to the border, you wouldn't send combat troops. You would send more National Guardsmen, who are just everyday people who happen to be in the military on the weekends and 2 weeks in the summer. So why send combat troops to the border if the whole stated purpose of these troops is to set up tents and to help border officials prepare for the caravan?
Well, I mean, I do think that this is political. I don't think that this would be happening if we weren't a week away from an election, particularly where the president's party is expected to do poorly. And I think the president is just trying to, you know, rile up his base with this notion. I think part of the reason that he's using these troops is because he's, you know, he's trying to recreate this narrative about the fact. In fact, this tweet today said that this is an invasion. He's used words like onslaught. And the reality is that to the extent that this is a crisis, it's a refugee crisis. This is not, you know, people who are intending to do harm. It's not people who are even intending to evade border controls. They're trying to turn themselves in. There's no reason to pull out military troops. If anything, we should be having, you know, humanitarian needs to help care for their needs, because they're fleeing tremendous violence. So I definitely think this is political, but I think the concern is that it's, you know, it's also creating this sense of the need for force and for violence, and that, you know, deeply worries me.
You know, this is something too that worries me, because as you just noted, there's a procedure for people coming to the border to request asylum, whether they're political refugees or economic refugees or whatever they are. There's a process in place. And so it seems to me that the logical and legal thing to do is to allow the process to do what it's supposed to do. Let people come to the border, let them fill out an application, allow them to come in until their argument can be heard, and then make a determination. I have no idea what armed combat troops are supposed to accomplish in a case like this.
That's right. And I mean, I think that the president is trying to, you know, really ultimately just, you know, signal that he doesn't want any, and he said it, you know, he doesn't want people coming to the United States from these regions. And he's trying to, you know, sort of send the message that's what he's trying to do. But the reality is that, you know, he's still got to operate within the law. And our law is very clear that if people have the opportunity to seek asylum, when they come to our borders, there's nothing illegal about that. And the group, you know, that traveled, you know, there's been these groups that have traveled, and it's important to understand that the reason that people travel in groups is simply because their own safety, because the trip is so dangerous, and particularly for the women that are traveling, there's tremendous levels of sexual violence that's happened when people are traveling by themselves. So the only reason that there's this group of asylum seekers and people fleeing violence is because they're trying to, you know, preserve their own safety. But when it's happened in the past, you know, most people have simply gone up to the port of entry and asked for asylum, which is entirely legal and in fact what is expected to them of them under international law.
Yeah, and another thing too that I think is not getting enough press play today is the fact that the number of migrants moving north has dropped dramatically, and it's because the Mexican government, and I saw an interview this morning with the Mexican ambassador to the United States, the Mexican government is offering to allow people to remain in Chiapas in southern Mexico because there actually are jobs in Chiapas and they would be easily integrated. Everybody speaks Spanish. It's close by Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and elsewhere. And nobody's really reporting on this.
Absolutely. And I mean, in some ways, you know, if anything, you know, the crisis has been exacerbated by the president himself, right? He's promoting this notion. And in some ways, I think some folks who are, you know, we're in a moment of deciding whether to flee the violence have decided to, you know, just because this group of people has gotten so much attention to join. But on the other hand, I think there are some people who are, you know, getting the message that, you know, the U.S. is not welcoming anymore. And so they're taking advantage of the opportunities that the Mexican government is opening for them. But at the same time, you know, there's some of the folks who are likely traveling because that's what we've seen in the past, who have family here in the United States and who would prefer to come to the United States. And they're entitled to, you know, seek protection here in the U.S. That's entirely consistent with U.S. law. So this idea that, you know, they're doing something wrong the way that the president is framing it is just completely inappropriate. And, you know, having met many, you know, people who've been fleeing the violence in particular the Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, it's, you know, completely understandable that people are deciding to, you know, do what's best for their families and themselves.
Jorge Barone is our guest. Jorge is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Jorge, the Marine anthem is from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Of course, the halls of Montezuma refers to the battle whereby the U.S. captured parts of or maybe all of Mexico City in 1847. That's how a big part of the southwest part of the United States actually became the United States, because it was part of Mexico. It's kind of an irony now that we have the Marines being sent back to the U.S.-Mexican border, this time not to capture people or to kill them necessarily, but to prevent asylum seekers from coming into the country to be able to make a claim, which is their legal right. Of course, they might not succeed in their claim, but that's their legal right. It seems that the Trump administration and the U.S. government, for all of its, you know, pronounced love of soldiers and love of Marines and love of sailors and love of veterans, is actually content to use Marines as more or less a political prop for this campaign directed against the migrant caravan and unarmed caravan, really just for politicking. Do you see it that way?
I do see it that way, but I'm also concerned about the fact that, you know, because we've seen over the years how having, you know, this you know, militarization of the border, both with actual troops, but even with just the way that Border Patrol operates, has had real profound consequences on the border communities and has led to, you know, unnecessary, unjustified deaths on both sides of the border, where people have been killed, who have been shot across the border in U.S. territory, and just completely unnecessarily. And so While I do think that this is a political, you know, notion and a ploy here, unfortunately, this is something that can have very real life consequences and frankly, fatal consequences. And I think the point you make about history, you know, is also an important one. I mean, you know, we could talk for hours about the history of U.S. intervention and what, you know, a lot of what's happening now. People are fleeing violence, particularly gang violence, that was, you know, in a sense created by the U.S. and its own policies. And at the same time, you know, the president is threatening that in order to do this, we're going to cut off aid, which is, you know, relatively small thing that we're doing, but it's the one thing that could actually have the potential of actually leading to a decrease in the flow of refugees and asylum seekers from that area. So we're just doing everything entirely the wrong direction if we actually wanted to try to solve the problem of that's leading to people fleeing the region.
Given the fact that quite a number of the people in the caravan have stopped their participation because they're incentivized with the possibility or the prospects of jobs, say, in Chiapas or elsewhere, it would seem like there could be, if this was a true emergency, they have, you know, 5,000 or 7,000 and now minus 2,000 people coming. There's lots of money around, actually, that a jobs program could be enacted that would actually satisfy some of the key demands or needs of the asylum seekers. Not as you're pointing out rightfully, that still for some it means coming to the United States to make their claim for asylum. It doesn't diminish that. But realistically, the economic hardships and the problems of just living life and the problems of poverty, which of course is a full-time job, it's such a dominant part of what the situation is. We're in America, we're in the United States, the richest country in the world, a country that can spend, you know, probably nearly $1 trillion a year. That's the real number on military spending. This would not be actually that complicated, at least to satisfy the needs of this caravan. Anyway, what's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for the amount of resources that we are spending in, you know, the troops, the detention centers, the border patrol, we could be investing that money in you know, in programs that have already proven when we have made, you know, sort of pilot projects and helping reduce gang violence and promote stability in parts of Central America. And I think we could, you know, do that a lot more and much more efficiently. And frankly, for a better result, because a lot of the people that I've talked to, you know, didn't want to leave. I mean, I think we have this notion that everybody wants to come to the U.S., but they just, you know, felt like they were forced to migrate. And so I think we'd end up with a much better outcome. But I frankly don't have a lot of hope that this administration is going to see it that way, given their America First rhetoric.
Okay, that was the voice of Jorge Barrón, who joined us from Seattle. Jorge is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced this morning that she would resign from the leadership of the Christian Democratic Party in December and would not seek re-election as chancellor in 2021. The announcement was unexpected, but comes in light of a resounding defeat for Merkel's coalition in recent regional elections in Bavaria. We're joined from Berlin by activist and journalist Diani Barreto. Diani, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Thank you for joining. Well, big week in Germany. A lot going on.
Historic week. It's an end of an era. It was quite an upheaval, but actually I think this is the time, the end game for Merkel, and they're finally paying attention. The pummeling that her coalition partners, the Social Democrats, got and her own party received, lost over 10 points. And you see how the big tent parties are going in either to the Greens, the voters are going to the Greens, or to this Alternative for Germany, which has now officially celebrated their last entry into a German regional parliament. That is actually the news of the day. Most people are not reporting on that. They got the largest gains in this whole regional Hessian election. And that's, again, the very disturbing, because that is one of the richest areas of Germany with the highest salaries, the lowest unemployment, and why voters would be actually flocking to the AfD is just because of voter discontentment, basically, is what also Merkel also acknowledged today in her statement. as also being one of the reasons that she's like taking personal consequences as being head of this Christian Democratic Union Party that she's been leading for 18 years. We are officially very weary of the Merkel effect in Germany, and that's what's being felt and seen in the changing political landscape in 2018. And of course, the Social Democrats are tone deaf and alienated, and in her sclerotic coalition, they can't seem to manage to do any effective changes within their party leadership. They're not even willing to change or even discuss party leadership changes, even after the pummeling they received. So we can just see there will be more gains for the AfD and the Greens that have now, you know, become the largest party. Another coalition with CDU in Hesse. But on the larger scale of things, of course, European politicians are sad to see her go because she is seen as this element of stability, of course. But the German populace is just this austerity programs, in spite of the largest trade surplus in the world, lack of infrastructure investment, lack of the largest wealth gap in Europe, here in Germany. Yeah, and the people are just, and again, we've got a new changing of demographics and digitalization, and people just don't feel like they are being included in, let's say, in fairness of equality of chances, you know, to improve their station in life. And so it doesn't come as a surprise, although she said she had taken this decision earlier in the summer, but this is particular to German politics, that in the CDU, which has been, you know, pretty much in government since the post-war, that the chairman usually holds the chancellery, but they just eked through this last election in Hesse. So she's taking the personal consequence of saying, okay, I'm stepping down and I'm not going to stand for re-election. She should have had this and announced this in December, because the Social Democrats also laid an ultimatum for her to say, okay, we've had so much infighting, we're frustrating the voters, that we have to do something, because, again, as I said, the grand coalition model has zero vision, is sclerotic, and is highly unpopular with the German populist voters. So the head of the Free Democrats, the liberals here, said, oh, she didn't step down from the right office, meaning that she should have stepped down as chancellor, which a lot of people are also echoing, saying this people didn't want this grand coalition. They didn't want her. They didn't want this. And it's time, I guess, to realize when it's time to leave, while you're ahead. And she said she wanted to carry out her office as a chairwoman and chancellor with dignity, and would like to finish her term until 2021. But I see this as highly unlikely, because we have three new elections next 2019. And if the AfD has more power than she does, or comes in stronger numbers, I don't see she's going to survive it.
Yeah. And there's different ways. I want to just, because Americans don't understand parliamentary systems. And of course, each one may be different, are different. In the case of Germany, the Christian Democratic Union Party, her party, a right-wing party, but not a far-right, or sort of a right-center.
It's center-right, and she brought it more to the center under her 18-year leadership.
Yeah. So they're going to have an internal convention in December. There's going to be a replacement for her as the chairperson of the party. If it's one of her allies, good, she can retain her position. If it's one of her enemies, and the enemy would be from the right, I would guess, within the Christian Democratic Union Party.
Exactly.
That might call into question of whether or not she could, in fact, retain the chancellor position, in which case there could be early elections. If that actually happens, I mean, we can see Merkel's on her way out. By 2021, she's gone. But she could be gone by 2019. Especially if the Christian Democratic Union Party falls under a more more right-wing sort of non-Merkel faction. Then there's an early election. Given what you're telling us, the traditional parties, the CDU party, right-center or center-right, the Social Democrats, center-left, if those parties are sort of going nowhere, then what would a new national election look like? Is it possible, is it conceivable that a far-right party like AfD could succeed at the national level? I mean, if I had asked you that question 3 years ago, I think we'd both say absolutely not, or I would have. But what about now?
That's an excellent question, and of course it begs the question. Interestingly enough, as you said, there is her mini Merkel, the general secretary of CDU that she had chosen, but she also said she would not get involved in a successor or in suggesting a successor. She's going to leave that to her party members to nominate a successor. But of course, two people have already, or three or four, have already mentioned today that they were willing to throw their hat into this bid for the head of the CDU. One is the general secretary, and the other one is the health minister that we have now, who, as you said, has been challenging her on her policies. And he has been advocating to go from this center-right to more right of center than she has. And yes, the AFD, the head of the AFD, commenting on her decision today, said it would be bad for them if this Jens Spahn, this minister of health that has been challenging Merkel, if he would make it to the head of the party, because all those disgruntled far-right voters in her party would maybe go back to the CDU. So they wouldn't have the numbers that they're having now. It also seems, based on this election that we've just seen, they did triumph into the last parliament in Germany. It seems like those numbers have plateaued at 13%. They, like in Bavaria also 2 weeks ago, a fortnight ago, they didn't make it beyond those numbers, at least in Western Germany. Eastern Germany is completely something other. And that's where, to answer your question, we'd have to see how these regional elections go. It's very possible, because we've already seen like very high numbers, you know, double-digit numbers, you know, almost over, they could make it over 20% or even higher if the sclerotic government continues to ignore what the voters are saying. They're very unhappy with the federal government policies, and that's what the voters are saying in the regional thing. We are fed up with Berlin and their government, and they're fighting all the time, and they're not governing. So it's conceivable, if they continue this route, that yes, at least in some of these regional elections, they might get some high numbers. I don't know if at this point, it's just too early in the game to think that if whether we'd have a far-right government at this point. I mean, I'm sure that the Greens might come ahead, because now they have become more connected maybe to what the Germans want in terms of policies, more progressive policies, also conservationist policies, and also to not go to the far right, essentially. That is the left, the new left alternative, that the social Democrats were in the past. So I think it's a bit too early. Of course, everyone should be very concerned at this point, because she was like the anchor and the stabilizer in European politics, and she had managed to stave off all of her challengers in the past. She's quite gifted in that regard. But now that era is over. So I think everyone is just basically reeling from what happened yesterday and today.
Yeah, the end of an era and uncertainty about what it means going forward. Certainly, we will continue to follow this. What happens in Germany will impact not only people in Germany, but all of Europe and indeed global politics. We were joined from Berlin by activist and journalist Diani Barreto. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The fight for stronger rent control in California appears to be headed for defeat. Proposition 10 would repeal the state's Costa Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which strictly limits rent control in cities across California. It's blamed for the state having some of the highest rents in the country, but the latest polls show that Prop 10 will likely be defeated, 60-40. We're joined from California by Natalie Harizi. She is a teacher and librarian and ran on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket for state insurance commissioner in California in the last election, and she received over 5% of the statewide vote. Natalie, it's been a long time. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be talking with you all today.
Natalie, this story just defies logic to me. California has some of the highest rents in the country. There are far more poor people and working people than there are wealthy people, especially in the Bay Area. So why is it that this proposition appears to be going down to defeat?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that it's sort of shocking in a way, given the actual conditions people are living in this state. But I think we can really chalk it up to the fact that real estate developers and landlords and investment bankers poured millions and millions of dollars into very slick ads that used working people against themselves, really. I mean, they highlighted tenants and veterans and seniors and other vulnerable working class people and used them for these ads or, you know, I don't even know, maybe they were actors just pretending they were working people. But the ads are very effective and they're very confusing. So they promote a lot of myths about Prop 10, which aren't true at all, but are very effective in terms of making a bad problem worse or has no protections for seniors and veterans. And these are, you know, things working people in the state care about. And it's been very confusing. So when we go out and we say, vote yes on Prop 10, this is what it really is. We're meeting a lot of people who are saying, well, I saw that ad. What does that mean? What does this mean? What's happening? There's not a lot of real information out there because they're just pouring millions into lies.
Yeah. Negative advertising works.
It works.
And
there's a lot of money, as she says, there's a lot of money being spent on this negative advertising.
Yeah. So again, how much is your side spending versus how much is the other side spending?
I mean, the numbers go up and up really every day. I was looking at it just this morning to try and get the most recent numbers. But it looks like, you know, the no on Prop 10 is sort of outspending the yes on Prop 10. 3-1 is what it seems like. It's millions of dollars. You know, and actually what's been great is that there are, you know, forces who are supporting yes on Prop 10 who have supported it and have put in, you know, millions of their own dollars, millions of dollars. Most common is Michael Weinsteiner, the head of the HIV Foundation. Sorry, he works a lot with housing and with the population that has AIDS and HIV. And he has put, I think, $14 million of his own dollars in. But I think what has happened is the millions of dollars that the real estate developers have put in have been just very effective in developing their ads. And yes, on Prop 10 is catching up. They have some really incredible ads going out there right now talking about the eviction of children. And you know, the average age of a homeless person in the United States is 9. So it's really key, critical to solving the housing crisis.
That's something, you know, we're talking about, and where Natalie is talking to us from San Francisco, you know, poor people are just driven out of the city. Black people have been driven out of the city. In New York City, we did a segment last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, Natalie, where 114,000 public school kids in New York City on any given day are homeless. 114,000, that would be one out of every 10. Amazing. And especially given the fact that most of their folks or their mom or dad or whoever they're living with, they're working. Those are working people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I read that study as well. And there's similar ones across the state of California, just showing that the state of California as a state is being completely gentrified. So in the major urban areas, you know, in Los Angeles, where rent is now for a one bedroom, the average is $1,690 a month. In San Francisco, it's $3,400 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. And people have been moving out of these cities hours and hours away from where they work, where they go to school, where the communities are. But now those areas are now raised, their rents are being raised, the cost of housing is going up, and people are moving to Texas and away from the state. Then, and you're right, poor people are just being driven out.
So, Natalie, can I interrupt you real quick? Say the number again. For a one-bedroom apartment, what's the average in San Francisco?
In San Francisco, the average for a one-bedroom apartment is $3,400 a month.
That's one bedroom.
Oh, my God.
One bedroom, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
So, if you have children, you can't fit into the one bedroom, probably, especially if you have two kids. So then you're talking about $4,000, $5,000 to rent. This is not with equity. This is rent. This is money that goes only to the landlord who has equity. I mean, that's what we're looking at. And the laws that Prop 10 are trying to repeal, to roll back, are the same laws that made this possible, this toxic mix of, you know, of capitalist greed, landlord greed, real estate developer greed, banker's greed, along with laws that make it almost impossible for working people to be protected from this kind of price gouging.
Right. So if you look at, so Proposition 10 overturns the Costa-Hawkins Act. And the Costa-Hawkins Act was a law passed in 1995 that limited rent control across the state of California. So no new developments after 1995 could have any rent control at all. And it backdated it for major cities. So in San Francisco and L.A., parts of L.A., not all of L.A., it backdated it to 1978 and 1979, which is incredible. To have no new housing be able to have any limits on rent control, in addition to single-family homes. So in single-family homes in San Francisco, the landlords can just raise the rent to whatever they'd like it to be.
Natalie, I want to ask you how things are done on voting day in California. Here in Virginia, and I'm sure Brian will say the same thing where he votes, I actually read the amendments and the propositions that are on the ballot. I stand there in the voting booth and I read them and I make a decision. Now, before you walk into the polling station, there are a lot of activists outside and they'll hand you a sample ballot. And on that ballot, they'll tell you the Democratic Party's position, the Republican Party's position on the various amendments and propositions. Have the Democrats, has the Democratic Party taken a stand on this proposition? And if so, are they going to push that that stand on Election Day?
The Democratic Party in California has supported the Yes on Prop 10 campaign, and that's great. I mean, it was really great when they came out for it because so many people do pay attention to the Democratic Party and get their bulletins and their numerous mailers. I mean, my mailbox is stuffed constantly right now with mailers, and I haven't seen anything from them yet. Although I have seen things from, you know, a lot of tenants, housing rights activists, advocates, really promoting Yes on Prop 10.
If it was a priority for the Democratic Party, they certainly, you would have heard from them about it.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Exactly. That's the point I was trying to make. I mean, maybe 100 feet out, they have to stand pretty far away. You can't stand right in front here in California. I don't know if that's everywhere, but definitely here you have to stand at least 100 feet away with your mailers and your palm cards and things like that. But I don't think the Democratic Party is really prioritizing this the way they could be. And I think that's part of the reason that we might be seeing, you know, the polls that we're seeing is they could take it up in a much bigger way.
Why don't they?
Well, I mean, what I've seen across this country is that the Democratic Party isn't taking up the issues of real working people need them to take up with. And I think that's true for housing. It's true for other issues. They don't really have a program of social justice for working people. And that's what, you know, Prop 10 is about really opening up an avenue for struggle for rent control. It's not even imposing rent control, except for in the few cities that have rent control, it's protecting it. But across the state of California, this would really open up struggle. And the Democratic Party hasn't been interested in that struggle, if ever, for many, many years. And they're certainly not leading the way on this issue.
Natalie, as we start to wrap up here, we have 90 seconds left. You ran on the Peace and Freedom Party for state commissioner on insurance. Now, people might not know what that is, but you ran on the platform of abolishing the private health care insurance companies, a radical program, but obviously a program designed to promote and facilitate single-payer health. You got 316,000 votes. Again, that's 5%, but that's a huge...
I think that's dramatic.
Yeah, and Natalie ran as a socialist on Peace and Freedom, calling for the abolition of the insurance companies on a shoestring budget. If I don't even know what shoestrings cost anymore. But Natalie, just it's a message that's obviously resonating, but still yet not finding its expression, at least through the two parties. You're part of the Peace and Freedom movement. Is it time for a third party? Is it time for an independent political movement? Is that the only way forward? Because from our point of view, it certainly seems to be the case.
I would absolutely agree. I mean, I think we're seeing across this country, anytime there's a moment that people are really standing up for the needs of working people, and that's what the Peace and Freedom Party does, that's what socialists do, is they stand up and say, housing should be a right, healthcare should be a right, and we can make it a reality if we really fight for it, we advocate for it. And neither of the capitalist political parties are doing that. Certainly not the Republicans and not the Democrats either. And I think the movement for third parties, the independent candidates that are coming out across the country that we're really seeing people respond to are those who are willing to take that stand. And I agree with you. I think the fact that 300,000 people voted for an open socialist who is standing against the insurance companies is a significant evidence of that.
I'm impressed by it. Well, we were joined from California by Natalie Harizi. She is a teacher and librarian, and she ran on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket for state insurance commissioner in California in the last election. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to hear your voices. How are you?
Oh, the pleasure's ours, Bill. You sent us an article from the New York Times entitled, Why Are We Still Teaching Reading the Wrong Way? This is your sweet spot. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the thing that knocked me out in the op-ed of the New York Times on Sunday was this article about reading. And, you know, it's one of these articles, it's a classic where the author has a deep political point of view, but masks it by saying, I want to tell you about the science of teaching reading. And so she cloaks her argument in kind of research and science, although she never cites the research and she never actually points to the science, but she insists that science tells us that the only way to teach reading is phonics. Now, I know that's not true, even though phonics is important, and making phonics or reading instruction ideological is kind of silly. But as you read through the article, and she's making a big case that a great error was made in American education when whole language, what's sometimes called whole language, or learning to read by being surrounded by books and being in a literate environment, this has been a huge mistake, and kids can't learn to read unless they're taught phonics. Now, let me step back and say there's some truth in that. Everybody who's been around little kids knows that you play with words and you play with phonics. You say M, like mother, or M, mom, maybe, you know, you do that. But the reality is that without a literate environment, you cannot really learn to read as simply decoding. Reading is meaning-making. But what killed me about reading this article, and the reason I drew your attention to it, is after she makes a big case against whole language instruction and for phonics, she gets to a paragraph where she says, the National Council on Teacher Quality reviewed the syllabuses of teacher preparation programs nationwide and found that fewer than 4 in 10 taught the components of effective reading. That's where she gives away the ideology. This organization, the National Council on Teacher Quality, is an organization designed to attack teacher preparation programs at the university. These are the people who want fast-track teacher certification, Teach for America, that kind of thing. And the idea that somehow it's scientific to review the syllabuses of teacher preparation programs is nonsense in its own right. But it's really funny that she takes this very simple thing, very calm thing about how kids learn to read, and turns it into this sword to slay teacher education programs. That's why I wanted to draw your attention to it. Let me just back up one more minute and say that kids learning to read is as natural as walking and talking if you live in an environment that's rich with literacy. And the schools in Chicago, the ones that are rich with literacy are the more successful schools, the ones that are stripped of books, that don't have libraries, that don't have reading specialists. Those are the schools that fail. And once again, returning to the theme we've talked about endlessly, the kids of privilege go to schools that are rich in literacy and literary opportunities. Those are the schools that Betsy DeVos's kids, Arne Duncan's kids, John King's kids, Barack Obama, and so on. Those kids go to schools where reading is considered a natural phenomenon. And if you are read to, and if you have opportunities to interact with books, that's huge. I used to wear a T-shirt when there was a group called Hooked on Phonics, and the T-shirt read, Hooked on Phonics, HKD on FONIX. That's Hooked on Phonics. So the idea that somehow phonics will solve the problems without attending to the question of resources, the question of access, the question of equity, is nonsense in its own right.
Reading has to be a priority, and it has to be a driven priority. But it's kind of an interesting thing, Bill. What you're suggesting is that reading, like speaking, like language, is in fact a species function. In other words, we are readers.
We are readers if we're in a literate environment. In other words, we are surrounded by words. In fact, if you go out of the studio today and just notice how much you are bombarded by words, it'll startle you because we take it for granted. if a kid is in a school where there aren't books, where they can't find access to interesting things to read, the walls are stripped of all literacy, that's an environment in which reading is tough. And then instruction becomes the whole way you think about reading. But the other thing to say about reading is that it's about making meaning. It's not about decoding stripped of meaning. It's always about meaning. And that's why kids learn to read emotionally. They learn to read words that are important to them. One of my grandchildren's first word was kiss. You know, another first word was baby sister. I mean, these are words that mattered to him because it was the world he was living in, right? So you have to not disconnect. You can't think of reading as a skill separate from meaning making or separate from living itself.
Bill, we've been having this debate in this country for, what, over 100 years, it has to be. Why have we not been able to settle on a technique that works? Why are there still, after all these years, so many different ideas out there?
Well, I think that, you know, technique is part of the problem, that there isn't a single technique. I mean, one of the things I learned, I've probably taught several hundred kids to read. I mean, because I was an early childhood teacher for a dozen years, so I've taught really literally scores and scores and scores of kids to read. But if I'm honest with myself, I'd have to say, actually, I witnessed hundreds of kids learn to read, and I created the environment, the provocation, the possibility, and the implements, and I had to draw on every imaginable technique. Yes, phonics sometimes, but also whole words sometimes. Also, kids writing their own stories sometimes. There were many, many techniques to draw on, but the reality is that without a sense that reading is more than decoding, you can't get there. The deeper answer to your question, I think, is something we've talked about in the past, which is all the ideas of cooperative learning, all the ideas of learning as a natural phenomenon come up hard against a capitalist ideology that says schools are sites of competition, not cooperation, sites of winners and losers rather than all of us learning together, sites of kind of viciousness rather than care and concern. I'm thinking right now, I think we all are, about the horrible, horrible mass murder in Pittsburgh at the synagogue, that ancient synagogue, and those 11 elderly people murdered. And I'm thinking about the pipe bombs coming out of Florida. And I'm thinking, what would Mr. Rogers do if he were teaching kindergarten and talking to kids in this kind of crisis? I mean, how do you explain to kids that the world we're living in is rife with hatred, spewed on from the very pinnacles of power? How do you get kids to think hard about how we live together in a society that seems driven more and more by fear, by hatred? And I think, again, going to Mr. Rogers, Mr. Rogers would say you have to look to the people who are the caregivers. You have to, every time there's a mass murder of Muslims in India, there are also Hindus who are hiding potential victims. Every time there's a shooting in a club, there are people who are taking care of other people. That's important that we remember, too.
Yeah, Bill Ayers is our guest. We talked to Bill, who's an award-winning author and an award-winning educator, about education issues in this segment called Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers. Bill, we have about 2.5 minutes left. I was looking at the New York Times this week. The headline is "A Dark Consensus About Screens and Kids Begins to Emerge in Silicon Valley." Quote, "I'm convinced the devil lives in our phones." Kristen Stetcher, a former social computing researcher married to a Facebook engineer in Menlo Park, said their daughters, age 5 and 3, have no screen time, quote, budget, close quote. No regular hours are they allowed to be on screens. And then here's the first sentence. "The people who are closest to a thing are often the most wary of it. Technologists know how phones really work, and many have decided that they don't want their own children anywhere near them." Talk about the impact or your own opinion on the issue of the screen time. Do computers, do cell phones, smartphones have an impact, or are they a significant part of the problem regarding kids and reading and education?
Well, I'm not sure I can comment on the breadth of that, except to say this, that it's important that we remember that the growth of a child is slow, that it takes time, that it's social, that it takes interaction. You cannot grow up and be a functioning human being all by yourself, isolated. You have to be in conversation. You have to be in communion. The other thing is we learn with all five of our senses, and that means we have to put our hands on the wooden blocks and build with them. We have to put our hands on the Cuisinart rods, and we have to play with the paint. I mean, the most significant thing to remember is that if you put kids in an environment which is rich in literacy, as we're talking about, and a simple metaphor, if you put kids near an easel with red, yellow, and blue paint and allow them to play with the paint, they will discover the color purple. They will. All my years of teaching, month after month, some kid would come up to me and say, look, red and blue makes purple. And I could have said, weren't you paying attention to the lecture I gave last week on primary and secondary colors? Or I could have said, wow, how did you discover that? What else can you discover? And that's the way learning actually works. You have to mess around in the world. You have to interact with the world and with other human beings. And then you begin to learn and put things together. I worry about anything that isolates kids. And I think it's critical that we remember that children grow slowly, deliberately, and socially.
My six-year-old and I had the same conversation about purple on Friday. Well, that was the voice of Bill Ayers, honest to God. Bill is an activist, educator, and the author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his important work at www.billayers.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.